Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. Now, I recently sat down with Scott Henderson, a Florida native from West Palm Beach who went to college at the Florida Atlantic University before moving to L.A. For those of you who are not familiar with Scott's work, he's played with the bassist Jeff Berlin, the violinist John Luke Ponte, Chick Corea, and Joe Zawinul from Weather Report. He explains how this all came about after leaving Florida.
When I was really young, I heard Zeppelin. You know, I heard two before one. So that record pretty much influenced me to start playing guitar. I just knew what I wanted to do after I heard that record. I just played around like the local clubs in West Palm Beach and Lauderdale, playing covers, and that was kind of during the disco era, so it wasn't that easy to find work because there wasn't much live music and it was hard. So that's why I moved to LA. I think I came here in 1980 to go to Musicians Institute, back when it was kind of more of a jazz school, and Pat Martino and Joe DiOrio and Joe Pass were teaching there. I just wanted to be a part of that scene, you know, and I figured that I'd probably stay in L.A. once I got here, because the South Florida scene, it just wasn't popping, you know, there just wasn't enough work. You know, a lot of musicians, really great musicians, because a lot of them graduated from University of Miami, and I went to Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton, and there was tons of really good players, but just not enough work. Jocko moved to New York, and most of those guys moved out of South Florida pretty soon after they got out of school because there's just not much happening. So that's kind of unfortunate. You know, I left a lot of my friends down there, you know, to come here and try to make a living. McLaughlin and Larry Coryell were kind of the very first jazz guitar players to buy Marshalls and turn them up and start that whole thing. You know, John McLaughlin became more known than Larry just because his band, not saying anything against Larry, but, you know, Mod Vision Orchestra was really, really inventive band. And not to mention that, you know, John McLaughlin, the combination of Tom McLaughlin and Billy Cobham and Jan Hammer, it was pretty much something that people had just never heard before. And I think that that's why on a commercial level, they became way more famous than what Larry was doing at that time. But you got to give Larry just as much credit for starting that whole movement as John, because they both were equally responsible for guys like me being able to do what we do. When I went to Florida Atlantic University, I took a lot of jazz courses and took some composition and arranging. But the thing is they didn't really have a guitar department. So it was difficult for me to relate all that stuff that I had learned onto the fingerboard. And that's why MI was, you know, or at that time it was called GIT, because it was only a guitar school. That kind of helped me relate all that theory that I'd learned to the fretboard. And that was more of a hands-on guitar school. And still is, actually, because I still teach there. I've been teaching there since, like, the year I graduated, in 81. I teach there a couple days a week when I'm in town. And, yeah, you know, it's more about, like, you know, showing students in a more practical way how to play guitar and learn all the theory stuff sort of at the same time, which is what they did at school, too. It's just that there weren't that many guitar players. Most of the students were either pianists or horn players, and it wasn't a really guitar-focused program. We're working on an advanced program right now that we're going to offer next year to more just like advanced guitarists who've been playing a long time and want to come just for a short time. The bass player, Jeff Berlin, he taught at MI when I was there. So I played a lot with him. We used to hang out and play with Joe Pass all the time. So Jeff got to know my playing, and he asked me to play on his first record, Champion. And I did some touring with Jeff, and then Jean-Luc Ponty heard that record. He's a violinist from France. I played with him for, I guess, 2 or 3 years. And then I started playing with Chick Corea. I didn't do that gig for that long. Didn't really dig it that much. I guess I was the first guitarist since Al, because he used Al back in Return to Forever. And then he started the electric band, and I was the first guitar player. But it didn't go so well between me and him. So it was like I didn't stay very long. It just didn't work out. It was kind of not what I expected, because I was kind of expecting the gig to be a bit more jazzy or a little more progressive. And it turned out to be kind of more of a commercial kind of a gig. You know, it was funny because the tune that he sent me first was called Silver Temple, and it's a beautiful tune, which is, to me, more characteristic of his great composing. He's a really great composer when he wants to be. I was really happy to play on that tune. Then he called me up and said, hey, would you like to do some gigs with us? And I said, sure, you know. And when I got the music for the rest of the set, I was like, oh, this music is nothing like Silver Temple. It's just more like kind of stuff they play on the wave. And I was kind of like, ah, I thought this was going to be like a bunch of really great music. It turned out kind of not to be. Wasn't really that into it. And then not only that, there was other commercial aspects of Chick's gig where he wanted kind of more of like a pop kind of mentality, where he wanted me to like walk out at the edge of the stage and play my solos, run around on stage and stuff. And I was like, dude, I'm just, you know, I got a stereo rig here. I'm kind of happy just to stay here between my speakers where it sounds good. I don't want to walk out to the front of the stage. You know, we had a lot of arguments like that. And I was like, God, I feel like I'm playing in a Vegas review here. It just wasn't the band for me. It just didn't work out. I really more was a fan of the Bill Connors era of that band. But you know what? I mean, you got to give it to Chick. I mean, he's an amazing improviser, and he's probably one of the best jazz pianists. Him and Keith Jarrett and Herbie Hancock are probably the three finest jazz pianists in the world, and it was a pleasure to hear him play, and just to hear him burning, man, every night was amazing. I mean, he's just a phenomenal player. He's so great at jazz and playing the Rhodes and acoustic piano, and I think that's where he really shines. And then I started playing with Zawinul when after Weather Report broke up. He started this band called the Zawinul Syndicate, and I was in that band for like 4 years. In fact, we played at the Musicians Exchange in Fort Lauderdale. During the time when I was in Chick's band, I kind of started Tribal Tech with the bass player Gary Willis, and then we did about 10 albums. I finally left Zawinul's band because Tribal Tech was getting so much work that I couldn't really be available for Joe when he needed me, so I had to bail. I didn't really want to because I was having fun playing with Joe. It was a lot of fun. I mean, I learned a lot, that's for sure, and he's a genius with harmony and just an incredible improviser and one of the best musicians I've ever played with, for sure. I'm sure the best musician I've ever played with. Yeah, it was a good learning experience, and plus he was a cool guy and fun to hang out with. I was there almost 4 years with Joe, and it was usually really fun, so I enjoyed it. We got to play quite a few, maybe six or seven of the old Weather Report tunes. Usually that's because we begged them to...
Scott explains how he created his own style of guitar playing and what influences he drew from when he goes in the studio and records.
As much as I hate to be compared to other players, I mean, there is a Jeff Beck influence for sure, but I've been listening to Jeff Beck for a long time, and Hendrix and Ritchie Blackmore, and a lot of people hear a lot of those influences in my playing. And there's some Scofield in there, and there's some who knows who, Pat Metheny, and I've listened to so many guitar players that I can't really state one influence anymore. It's just all kind of morphed into whatever it is. Basically, just Marshalls. I think I used some Fenders, too, an old Fender Bandmaster. I'm into vintage amps and pedals and real speaker cabinets. I'm not really too much into the gizmo world. So it's just really pretty simple stuff, like going through a pedal and right into the amp and putting a mic on the speaker cabinet. That's about it. Now, I do actually have some pretty wacky pedals that are just designed to make noises and stuff. But there are some really great plugins from Sound Toys, like Echo Boy and the Crystallizer. And there's a lot of really great stuff that they make that can really add a lot of non-guitar type of tones to your music. And I mean, it still sounds like guitar, but it's highly processed guitar and sounds really weird and spacey. And, you know, I use a lot of that kind of stuff. You know, when you're doing a guitar trio record, I just try to color it up as much as I can and layer it and make it sound big and as many sounds as I can possibly muster up to make the record interesting, you know, tonally. And I think I used, there's a sitar on one tune. Electric sitar. Then I borrowed my friend Bruce Foreman's hollow body for the last tune, the standard, and I use a telly on a couple tracks. So just trying to keep each song sounding a little different from the other one. Most of the time, my tracks on an album is just one track. It's like, there's the guitar track, I'm done. And on a trio record, you know, I do a lot of layering, and sometimes there's like five or six tracks going on at once. It's an art and it's fun. You know, I really enjoy doing it. And I think I've enjoyed listening to those kind of records because that's what Jimmy Page did with Led Zeppelin. Lots of guitar tracks, lots of layers. Mike Landau does a really good job with layering. I'm a fan of his. I mean, I don't want to layer so much that I'm not able to play the tunes live. If you listen to the tunes, there's always a basic guitar track. It's the main guitar track, and that's pretty much what you hear when you hear the trio live on stage. I mean, I don't want to really record anything that I can't pull off live. You know, on these trio records, I'm not playing the chords with a chord sound and then playing a lead sound on top of that, because I wouldn't be able to pull that off live. So most of the melodies on the new record are sort of played in a chord melody style so that I can play the melody and the chords at the same time. That's sort of become my style for playing trio because I don't want to use loop pedals and have to loop chords while I play melodies and stuff like that. I just sort of developed my own little style of playing chord melody, and it's not like a traditional style of, you know, bebop guitar because it's a little distorted. You know, we did this album, HBC. It's with Jeff Berlin and Dennis Chambers. We played a lot of Weatherport music on that record in a guitar trio. Talk about layering. I was basically just copying from the Weatherport records because I wanted to get the arrangements as close as possible to the original. So I just sort of like had to listen to those tunes over and over and listen kind of deep down, because Joe always likes to put stuff that you can barely hear in the mix. There's a lot of stuff going on underneath that you probably don't hear at first listen, but if you listen hard, they're down there. And I had to try to cop those things too. So there's a lot of guitar tracks going on at once. And then I tried to get the sound as close to Joe's sounds as I could, not being a keyboard player, but, you know, it was a fun project because I'm a big Weatherport fan, and it was fun to just try to get as close to those arrangements as I could.
Scott explains the whole recording process and the musicians that he used in the studio while recording Vibe Station. He also has some helpful advice for musicians out there.
It's Travis Carlton on bass, and he's Larry Carlton's son. And Alan Hertz is the drummer. He played in Garage Mahal for a long time, and they did the kind of hippie jam circuit for a long time with that band. He moved down from the Bay Area and lives here in L.A. now. And he's also the engineer for the record. He's a great engineer. He's one of the best engineers I've ever worked with. We actually did it on 96K in the Mac. And then when we gave it to Joe Gaswert, who's like my favorite mastering engineer in L.A., he ran it to half-inch tape before he mastered it. I got to tell you, Mike Vardy is one of the nicest cats. I mean, I've been with him for such a long time, and I don't just consider him a business associate. He's a really good friend. And he was just kind of telling me, Scott, you know, I really don't think you need me at this point. You've got a name. You've got a booking agent. You can hire CD Baby to do this. And they're kind of like more like a worldwide company now. You know, you can get it on iTunes and Amazon and all the digital partners. You make so much more money. I got to say, I mean, I've made more money off this record than I've made off any record I've ever done. CD Baby gives you $11 to when you sell a CD for $15 on CD Baby, they give you $11. That's like so much more than any label is going to give you. You get like for a $9.99 sale of an album on iTunes, you get $9. That's like amazing. And plus, I mean, I'm able to sell CDs on the road and they only cost me $1 something each to print them. And the profit margin is so much better. I kind of recommend for any musician who wants to make money to kind of stay away from labels. You have to do a little more legwork. You know, you have to mail big boxes of CDs over to CD Baby, but it's not a big deal. It's pretty easy. As long as you hire a publicist, I mean, I think that's the most important thing. And I hired this guy who I really like, and he did a great job getting the word out. The album was out and it's doing well. And yeah, I couldn't be happier, man. I mean, I think this is the way to do it. I have a little studio that's only big enough to do, like, say, guitars or vocals or stuff like that. I can't record drums or bass. So we went into a really nice studio to record the album. It's called King Size Sound Labs, and it's only like a couple miles from my house. And it's just a great room. They have a nice Neve board. And I live in Eagle Rock in L.A., Yeah, there's a lot of good studios around here, and this one is, it's perfect for us because it's not one of those big L.A. studios with, like, the huge, big wooden room. It's great if you want the John Bonham drum sound, you know, where it's just got tons of room sound with it. You know, we're playing kind of more jazzy and tight, funky stuff, so we want more of a dry room, and this room was perfect for the kind of music that we play. You know, big, but not too big, and a little deader because it had, you know, acoustic panels and stuff, and just was a really great room to record in with a good Neve board. And we got some great drum and bass tracks and some good scratch guitar tracks from it because I didn't keep a whole lot of what I played live in the studio. I kept all the ideas. Like if I played certain rhythms, I had to re-record them the same so that it would match what I played live. But I always get better tone in my studio than I do at someone else's. Well, one of the reasons is because I can't turn up loud enough to make the amp sound good. It all bleeds into the drum mics. And then there's no separation. So, you know, we had such good interaction in the studio, but I did have to re-record a lot of the stuff I did. And some of it actually verbatim. I had to actually learn what I played and play it again with better tone because my amp, I think, in the basic tracks was on one. Otherwise, it was like all in the drum mics and just messing everything up. And normally, I play the amp on about 6 or 7, and yeah, I had to turn way down. So it was sound pretty thin sounding. And I've always had that problem on basic tracks. I can never find, I don't think there's a studio in LA where you can crank up 100-watt Marshall and not have it bleeding into the drums somehow. We worked really hard on it, and one thing that I'm really kind of proud of is the interaction between, you know, me and Travis and Alan on the record, because we had been playing these tunes on the road for quite a while before we recorded them, so that really helped. I always find that the biggest amount of time that it takes to go out and play those tunes for like 3 or 4 tours to really get them like at their most burning before you go in the studio and record them. I think that's why it takes so much time between albums, because I really do like to go out and play the music quite a bit before we go in the studio. If you write the tune and just rehearse the tune and go and record it, then you go out on tour and the music just grows and becomes so much better, you're kind of kicking yourself that that's not on the record. I have made that mistake with Tribal Tech, especially on the earlier records. We weren't really touring that much because we couldn't get gigs. We were too new of a band. And so on the first, like, 4 or 5 Tribal Tech records, that music, it sounds kind of stiff to me because we never got a chance to go out and really play live. Whereas on the later Tribal Tech records, the music is way more interactive because we were jamming more in the studio and we were, you know, we had a chance to go out and play the tunes live and everything was just more organic. The newest thing is this tour. Crazy tour that I'm about to go on. We're going to Korea for a few days and then China for a week and then Europe for a couple of weeks and Russia for a week and then Central America for like a week and a half. I don't normally do this. We usually go to one place, come home, go to another place, come home. This is kind of like, I guess they just want to do it all at once. It's going to be like almost a 2-month tour. So a little bit long for me because I have a daughter, I have a 12-year-old here and 3 dogs, and kind of hard to take off and leave them for that long. But could be worse. I could be in a rock band like Guns N' Roses and they go out like for 3 years at a time. They never come home. Yeah, I couldn't deal with that, man. The jazz world is a lot easier. You just go out for 3 weeks here, 3 weeks there. It's not a big deal.
Like many professional guitarists out there today, Scott has his own signature series guitar, and he explains working with guitar luthier John Sir to get his signature tone.
I've been playing Sir guitars for a really long time. Ever since John Sir was a master builder at Fender, he made me a Fender guitar, and I really liked it. And when he started Sir, about, I guess that's got to be almost 20 years ago, I was his first endorsee. I went from Fender to Sir. They're just Strat clones. They really are nice and light, and they sound like vintage 50s and 60s Strats, only the necks are easier to play because they're flatter radius, and big frets, and so it's like playing a vintage Strat that's easy to play. The thing about Sur is his stuff is custom order, so if you wanted small frets, you could order small frets. You can get anything you want. He doesn't really make anything standard. I mean, they have their standard models that they sell to dealers. I mean, anybody can call them and order a guitar to any specs you want. So it's a total custom-built type of thing. My signature guitar is basically a really simple Alder body Strat. I mean, it's just as simple as can be. No crazy paint, because the paint, you know, if you go nuts with the candy apple colors, you kind of mess up the tone. Mine are really just thin layers of one color paint. He makes two pickups that I really like. He makes the V60s, which is about as close as you can get to the real pickups that they had on the old Fender Strats, the vintage ones. Then he makes the Mike Landau version, which is a little bit hotter with a little more mid-range, and I like those too. They're just a different color. Then he has this noiseless system, which is really awesome, where he drops a dummy pickup into the wood under the pick guard, and that makes it humbucking with the other pickups, so there's no noise. It cancels all the hum. Stevie Ray always had a dummy pickup, but the difference is that if you drop a real pickup into your guitar, you're going through about 6,000 ohms of wire, which can really take some of the treble out of the sound, and that's why a lot of the guys that did that had to jack up the treble on their amps a lot more to compensate for it. John's dummy pickup is sort of like the wire without the magnet. There's only 200 ohms, you know, of wire in there, so you really can't hear the difference. The hum is gone. So it's a really nice system that him and Jim Kelly invented them, and it just works like a charm, and it's really awesome.
I always really enjoy speaking with guitarists and seeing what their little tricks and traits are and how they get their tone and any kind of insight they give to their guitar playing. So now here he is, Scott Henderson with Vibe Station. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.